All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
Yeah, well, can I see your fucking profile picture from like 2007?
I don't know. I'm on my laptop in it, so I'm not sure what the video looks like.
Just whack it on, let's have a look.
Looking a bit crime watch.
How are you, son?
Safe, man. Should I keep this on or not? I don't know if it's worth...
I think you're better off keeping it on, just for...
You only can see half my face anyway, because for some reason I'm looking straight at the laptop, but it's...
I can see your whole face.
Yeah, I'm not going to be looking at you much anyway, because I'm on my laptop, so I'm going to have the script up a lot of time. Where's Flynn?
He's in there chatting up my missus.
Oh, is he? Oh, in Spanish. No.
Oh, no. Exactly what's going on, look.
Fucking
Feliz up. Okay, I can't wait to kick him out, man.
Go back to fucking Barca, man.
Is this going to be problematic for you on the video because it's kind of blocking out your face?
Oh, yeah.
Move it this way.
It doesn't matter too much. I don't know how much I'm going to be looking at your two beautiful faces anyway, because I'm only on one screen, innit? So I'm probably going to have the script up for most of it anyway. So
a millionaire
that much. Well, probably not going to matter. But
look at us,
pretty fucking slack.
Innit? Yeah.
Are you too important now? You're in the Big Apple.
Absolutely raving.
Oi, where's this sun?
where's
the floor?
Is that my light things right there, mate? If I can get started, we've got 23 pages of a document that I've...
Is it 23 now? What the fuck? It was like 18 the other day.
Is it 23?
Did you put loads on there the other day?
Yeah, there's loads of nonsense.
I tricked a few things in today as well.
All right, so fuck it. Yeah, we'll just get started then. Yeah, you're coming through fine.
Yeah,
sweet.
Okay, let's get started then. New episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. I'm back in New York. You lads are both in Jim's abode. How's it going, lads?
Absolutely spectacular. And I didn't realise Flynn was leaving on Monday, so I'm actually really sad. But this is a good way to spend the last podcast before he leaves, so I'm glad we're doing it in person.
It's actually a pretty gross flat, to be honest with you.
Shanty.
Happy to still be in Birmingham, and it's beautiful. Jim's flat's beautiful.
Yeah, we do sell a bit of smack out of here now and again, but you got to make ends meet. We can't all be part-owning flats in Milton Keynes. You know what I mean?
And the mulled wines as well, Jim, I see.
Perish the thought, mate. This is Ribena.
So the preamble ramble this week has got to be about the AFCON, because it's been an absolute nightmare, and that's to be fair. So Jim, you picked up on something in the first couple of days. I'll chip in with what happens in the Tunisia versus Mali game. What was it that you saw that you picked up on?
The African Cup of Nations has comprised a slew of scoreless draws and 1-0 so far, and the broadcast coverage has been Blair Witch levels. I don't know if you've seen it. It's like actually disgusting. It's like as if the cameramen are just pissed and they're working with like 2K Windows fucking software. It's disgusting, man. It gave me a headache just looking at it. But there was some comedy to be found in the game between, is that Guinea-Bissau.
Yeah. And Tino will know the flag. No matter what African country it is, Tino will definitely know the flag.
So the criminally overnamed Pele, who plays for the lesser-known GB squad, he had a penalty saved. And this seemed to trigger a FIFA-like glitch in the Matrix that prohibited three other players in his team from scoring the follow-up. One hit the crossbar, another dragged his shot wide, then another latched onto that miscue, only to slam his shot into the side net in absolute Charlie Chaplin stuff, man.
Is that the Pele that played for Nottingham
Brazil,
Forest?
1976. Yeah, that's
the same dude.
No, I think there was, because I remember Forest at one point, they had like a Cafu, a Pele, and like another geezer that was named after like a really famous footballer. And they had like these three players that were like like the absolute, what do you call them?
The goats.
Yeah, well, they said called the goats, but they were fucking frauds, basically.
Strictly for the shirt sales, isn't it? For not
yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. I think it is. Yeah, Guinea-Bissau. Yeah, it's the Pele that was at Forest for a little bit. The other thing I picked up on was the carnage in the Tunisia versus Mali game yesterday. I think people are using this as kind of like, this is the reason we don't watch the AFCON, and it, do you know what I mean? It's a bit unfortunate, really, because I think like the African Cup of Nations authorities, they wanted to big this tournament up and try and, you know, get people more interested in it and start taking it a little bit more seriously. And then this happened in the game, I think it was Tuesday. So basically the referees blew the whistle in the 86th minute And I don't know what happened, whether he's sort of like he's got the timing wrong or whatever. He didn't add on stoppages from the first half or however he's done it. Anyway, he's made the mistake. The fourth official has told him that obviously there's something wrong. So maybe he's got a faulty watch. Play subsequently restarted. And then a minute later, he sends off a Mali player, to which the VAR told the ref to reverse the decision. The referee disagreed with this and rejected the VAR call. And then he ends up blowing for full time with only 89 minutes on the clock. And then this time it was like done and dusted. He was like, nah. Apparently he was suffering from sunstroke. I'm not sure how much of that is legitimate. But both teams ended up leaving the field. The Malian players started conducting post-match interviews when the Afghan officials ordered both teams to get back on the field and resume the game. But the Tunisian team, oddly enough, didn't comply. They stayed in the dressing room, probably already having a lawyer in there talking about their options and how they can basically sue Afghan. But as I said, in a year where, you know, they wanted to be taken seriously as a legitimate tournament on the world stage, it's all like falling to pieces for them, really. So it's a bit unfortunate, I think.
Yeah, well, I wonder why they don't get that primo summer slap alongside like the World Cup and the Euros, man. Must be just racism, you know what I mean?
It's nothing to do with all these 1-0s.
Absolute shambles of administrative processes. You're telling me there's not enough money to put on a proper football game? And as if the ref, yeah, to be fair, I think more referees should do that. But no, I'm not really feeling that replay. I think I'm just going to go with my gut instincts. Old school, 1966.
We talk about the VAR decisions quite a lot, and I think it's quite refreshing to see a ref go, nah, fuck that. I'm going to make my own call. We moan about that a lot.
Who's the authority here, me or the video? You know.
But Flynn, you picked up on one as well that from the other day, wasn't it? Was it Mauritania game?
So as if everything we've already talked about isn't enough, Mauritania were asked to sing their own national anthem without music.
Because they couldn't find the track.
They played the wrong tune three times. And as far as I can find out, they played their previous national anthem before whatever revolution.
So it wasn't like they were playing like it wasn't like they were playing like
every 6 months. It gets a bit complicated, doesn't it, to be fair?
But look, I know we had a moan about the Afghan last week, but I can't wait to see what else happens. I think this has been brilliant so far.
But fair play to Nigeria. A hot tip to go deep in the tournament from Bissett Betts. They handed Mo Salah's Egypt their first defeat in the Afghan group stages in 18 years. So up the Super Eagles. They're a team that I hope go far into the tournament. I think Cameroon have looked pretty good so far. I did read today that Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang is out of the Gabon team. He's not even in the starting lineup, so I don't know what's going on there.
You know, he must not have just called the Gabon manager after he went to France for a few weeks, so I can just get absolutely kicked out of there. But I was going to say something mildly racist, I imagine. No, I'll just leave it, innit? Just leave it. We'll cut that in the edit.
Maybe best to leave
it. Oh, no, that's what I was going to say. It wasn't mildly racist. It was just a bit...
This is strongly racist.
Yeah. Absolutely, 100%. I'm doubling down. No, but have you heard the general conversation that since Mo Salah's started playing for Egypt, since he's gone to Egypt, he's like, mate, you're playing with 10 geezers who are like Sunday league level. You're not going to be the same quality as when you're playing with a bunch of world-class players. Same with Mane. And it's such a disingenuous line of thought. Of course he's not going to be as good playing for Egypt, man. Where are they? They're like, what, are they 80th in the world or something like that? You should leave it alone. But then again, Liverpool struggled against Arsenal the other night. They were down to 10 men, so they're missing them as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think the fact that they were, what, they had 70-odd minutes, 68 minutes, something like that, where Arsenal were down to 10 men and Liverpool still couldn't break them down. So it shows you how much they rely on the sort of productivity of Mane and Salah, to be fair. But as you say, like when your players like that and you're in a team, you know, that they've got Trezeguet, I think, who plays for Villa. But like I've spoken to Piers and he just really doesn't rate him. I don't think he's sort of like Premier League standard. I think they've got Hegazi that used to play for Albion in centre defence. But you start to, you know, struggle to see any sort of like popular names or any high profile names in a team from then on. Senegal, I think, have got a good side. Ivory Coast are looking pretty good. They left out Pepe and Wilfried Zaha the other day. And I think they still end up winning. So they've got like firepower on the bench as well. So there are a few teams that would probably be able to mix it up in the World Cup. But as you say, you never get an African team that really gets further than what, the quarters. I think, I think Uruguay played Ghana in the quarters a few years ago. I think that's one of the furthest an African team's ever got in the World Cup. That was when Suarez and the old biting incident, I think. Or
which one, mate?
Which one?
Yeah. Was it a handball? No, it might have been a handball incident. Anyway, some sort of cheating debacle that was, you know, that Suarez was at the centre of. Go on.
I think Chris Wood would walk into the Ivory Coast team anyway, mate. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, we'll talk about some transfer news that's been happening in the Premier League. Obviously, Chris Wood being one of the main sort of transfers of the week, really. And he's completed a £25 million move to Newcastle. And I just thought initially, I was like, him and Burnley must be absolutely licking their lips. I think Burnley are probably getting around four times the market value for who is essentially, in my opinion, a glorified championship player at the age of 30. Right, he's been in the Premier League, I think, for about 4 or 5 years now, but he's definitely trebling his wages, I'd imagine, or at least doubling it. And I just think the circus has landed, really, hasn't it, with Newcastle?
Well, I was watching this, what's it called now? TIFO, that football channel.
Yeah.
And they were going over, like, basically making a case for why Chris Wood is good value. It was basically about Newcastle. They've got a shit midfield. And Chrissy Wood is good in the air. He's, like, the best at winning aerial duels in the entire league. So that means if they play the long ball, he can, like, head it down or bring other players into play, which means that Newcastle's midfield aren't so much of a liability and they end up defending higher up the pitch. Now, do you feel like there's any credence to that at all, is it?
Well, a bit like Andy Carroll. How did that work out for him when they re-signed him? Do you know what I mean? Yeah, I think it feels like a bit of a contingency plan as well, because I think if they did get relegated this year, I think he would do very well in the Championship. I think the last time he was in the Championship, he scored like 26 goals in the season. So I do feel there's a bit of contingency with the players are signing. Him and, say, and Trippier as well. Trippier is still definitely Premier League quality, but he would also be a good asset if they do get relegated. I think Chris Wood, he moved from Leeds to Burnley in 2017 for £14.75 million, which, you know, arguably was probably a good value for what he was at 26. Obviously, 26 being the sort of prime age for a striker. So £14.75 million makes sense. So Burnley have made a profit on this after 5 years of pretty decent service. You know, Premier League, I think he had three or four seasons where he got a minimum 10 goals, which ain't bad for a striker, really, especially for a team that have sort of, you know, fighting to avoid relegation most seasons. So fair play to him in that respect. But he's only got 3 goals in 17 appearances this season. And, like, for me, that is not great value. What do you reckon, Flynn?
What I reckon. So on the face of it, I don't think it's good value. But for Newcastle, it's not something they need to really worry about at the moment. They've got more money than anyone else in the world. I don't think they need to really worry about the value. He's got a couple of benefits for Newcastle. He might be able to keep him up. He might not, but he might. And if they go down, like what you touched on earlier, he's got loads of experience in the Championship. And I think he's come up a couple times from the Championship with teams. He's got experience in doing that with teams. So he could really help them if they go down, which they might do. But I think the most important point, which people aren't talking about, is that Newcastle have taken a top striker from a relegation rival. Oh, doesn't matter the price. Mm-hmm. Burnley's a relegation rival and they've taken their top boy. And I think that's more. I think that's worth more than the price. Newcastle can afford doing that. I think it's quite a clever move. And also, I'm sure you as a Blues fan will appreciate, he's always still a legend for that Bruges goal, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The 97th minute Bruges goal or whatever it was. Yeah. We always remember where we were when that went in. But yeah, I mean, it's a fairly valid point, taking a strike away from your rival. Important player for Burnley, you'd have to say. But they are going to get a chance to reinvest that 25 million, aren't they? It's not like...
Well, I would put it to you, even with that 25 million, I've got, realistically, who's going to come to them?
People will go
to Newcastle with their new owners. Who's realistically going to go to Burnley now?
Well, they signed... They made an absolute great signing with that Maxwell Cornet in the summer. Relatively unheard of player. I think they signed him from the French leagues. He's over in the AFCON at the moment. I think he might be in the Senegal team, or was it Ivory Coast? I can't remember which one it was. But I think he scored 5 or 6 goals. He's getting assists for him. He's scoring goals. he looks a great player, and they signed, they picked him up for 5 or 6 million. So they could do something similar. They could maybe go and try and sign a player out of the Dutch leagues, out of the French leagues, that has been scoring consistently for decent sides. And you never know. The thing is with these players that come over from, you know, these sort of, you know, the lesser European leagues, some of them struggle, like Sebastian Haller did at West Ham. And then he's gone on to be a revelation for Ajax. But some of them do adapt pretty well. So I think they could definitely go and maybe sign a decent striker for 8-9 million.
It's a risk. I think I think Newcastle made the more shrewd decision here. They made a good choice, I think.
And also, I think a factor is that Sean Dyche has made a career at Burnley out of balancing the books. I can't really see him just taking that 25 million and spending it on someone straight away. I think he'd probably go for a cheaper option just to like bank a bit of dough. He might not, like, this might be one of those times where the board like say, look, we need to reinvest. As Flynn said, you've just took our top striker. We need to like, solidify in that area of the pitch. So that could go either way, but I can't see him splashing that cash straight away, especially for like wages, etc. I just don't see it like that. They're about existing in the Premier League, aren't they? They're not really about doing much else other than a cup run, I don't suppose.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what they do. I think they'll definitely reinvest it in maybe 2 or 3 players. I think that'll probably be their strategy going forward. I think they probably thought, right, we've signed him for 15 million. We've made a 10 million profit on him. And he's been a good servant for the club for the past, what, 5-6 years. That strikes me as good value for them. Do you know what I mean? So I think they're going to reinvest that money going forward in January. So it'll be interesting to see what sort of players they come in for in the next couple of weeks. But Stevie G continues to conduct his orchestra with another huge signing for his Villa team, as Everton fullback Luca Dean looks to have made his medical. He's passed his medical now, ahead of his £25 million move, which has now been confirmed. The French international was a high-profile signing under the Farhad Moshiri regime in Merseyside after his move from Barcelona in 2018. So this guy's got Champions League experience for a plethora of clubs, Lille, PSG, Roma, and the aforementioned Barca. This guy has been playing at a high level for quite a long time now. He's had a couple of successful seasons at Everton. At the age of 28, this feels like another great signing for Villa. What do you think?
If I can jump in, I think so. It looks like he's going to be replacing Matt Target, if I'm not mistaken. And by all accounts, that's going to be an improvement. And it might be a step towards taking them to the next level that we all know Gerrard wants to take them to. He's got a few experience in the Premiership. We know he can hack it. It's not like getting someone from Spain or Italy or Germany who's never been in the Premiership before, someone who could be amazing there. We bring them over to the UK and they're not able to hack it. We know he can. He may even help the club attract top players. Though, I was speaking to Conor Flynn, just on a slight tangent, he reckons Coutinho is going to flop. He's not biased at all, but he flopped before Liverpool. He's flopped after, and he might flop again.
You know what? That echoes what I heard at work this morning, to be fair. But this guy was a Baggies fan, and it's the same kind of Flynn vibe. They're like, Coutinho, man, he's got COVID. You watch next week, he's going to pop his knee. They're just going to be paying X amount a week for nothing. It's like, they just, no one wants this guy to do well at Villa. And I think it's the perfect situation scenario for him to absolutely rip it up, man. I think he's going to kill it.
I think he might. Yeah.
If he stays fit, he's going to smash it, man. No doubt.
I like the circumstances that he's coming into. He's coming into, you know, a club where there's not that much expectation. So I don't think he's going to have that much expectation to perform. He's coming into a club where that's coached by somebody that he knows and that respects him and thinks he's a good footballer. So he's going to have that sort of emotional support that's going to help him along, which perhaps you don't get when you go to a club like Barcelona. And, you know, everybody expects the world of you as soon as you go there. You know what I mean? They expect everything in such a short amount of time. And sometimes when it doesn't happen early, it starts to spiral. And we've seen that with loads of teams that have gotten to those big teams, loads of players that have gone to those big teams in Spain, Real Madrid, Barcelona. The expectation sometimes weighs them down, doesn't it? So I think him coming to Villa is going to be, that weight's going to be lifted, I think. I think the circumstances and the environment's right for him to perform. So, and along with a player like Luca Dean, who last season for Everton, he was first in 4 key areas of assists and creating chances. So he was Everton's top player in creating assists. He was Everton's top player in creating in chances created, also in passes into the opposition box, and he was also top in open play crosses. So that's going to be a huge asset for Villa, really. When you've got players like Danny Ings, you got players like Ollie Watkins that can, you know, really get on the end of crosses and sort of, you know, get into good positions in the box. You know, it's really looking up for Villa, man. It kind of grieves me to say it, but I can really see him kicking on now. If they can sign one major signing now, centre midfielder, I'd like to see him sign. If I was a Villa fan, I'd want to see a really, really top centre midfielder. I think they can have a really good end of the season. Let's talk about Ousmane Dembele a little bit. And I was having a chat with him with a couple of guys the other day.
Chatting to him casually the other day. I was like, yeah. Who's he, mate?
She just gave him a little call the other day. Now, but he's going to be a free agent in the summer. So I think there's been a lot of heat surrounding him and about where he might potentially go in January. But don't forget this, he's only 24, right? He signed for 140 million euros in the summer of 2017, which was a hell of a lot of money for a 21-year-old at the time, who was fairly unproven. Came from Borussia Dortmund and really has had a torrid time for Barca. Off the field, he can feel pretty good about himself, however, as he's earned himself an eye-watering 57,800,000 in wages in the period he's been at Barcelona, which is astonishing, really. And it further highlights the gross mismanagement of the club. That's Barcelona in recent times. So 128 appearances he's played for Barcelona. He scored 31 times, which works out at around 1.8 million euros a goal. So who signs him? Who would really want to come in and manage this contract? And would he get a significant contract if he did move somewhere?
I reckon even now, his name alone will probably get him a contract. I don't think his agent really needs to do too much. I think age is on his side, but I don't know. What do you guys think? Do you guys see a Newcastle or a Villa taking him on?
Listen, I think he's going to have no trouble getting a contract at any of the top clubs. Maybe not like Bayern Munich or something like that. Or maybe not, you know, I could see him going somewhere like City or... Because he's 24, and I remember when he first went to Barca, he was absolutely ripping it up. And it's unfortunate that Barcelona have been spiraling the way they have, because his performances could be reflective of the general vibe around the club rather than him not performing up to his potential, even though they all players have to take a bit of responsibility for what they're doing. But like, everyone's playing like shit there at the minute. So I think if you get him out of that circumstance, similar to Coutinho, give him a new objective, give him a new stimulus, like just get him out of that bad place. I think he could play in any team in the world, really, and succeed. Like, he's a sick player, man. But could you see him going to, I don't want to say United, because they're like such a patchy team, but like somewhere like Chelsea or even Real Madrid, or I could see him in any of those teams easily.
Yeah, I think it's just going to be a wage concern, man. If he's been earning such, you know, a large amount of money, what, 230 odd grand a week at his age, he's not going to want to go and take a wage cut, particularly, is he, at 24 years old? He'll be thinking, right, this, I'm in my prime. Do you know what I mean? Physically, I'm in my prime, so I should be earning the most amount of money I can at this age.
It's going to be worm tonguing as well, you know, worm tonguing in his ear. Fucking, you should be at 300 grand a year, mate, or a week even. That's a week. That is ridiculous amount of money, isn't it? That is.
So it's going to be interesting to see where, you know, obviously with his contract running out in the summer, he'll be eligible for one of those like pre-contract talks. I think they can do 66 months before I think they can start talking about contract negotiations. So it'll be interesting to see where he goes. But yeah, as you say, like, I hope he can sort of like try and, you know, get back to that form that he had when he first went to Barcelona. But we'll talk about Arsenal, and they're showing strong interest in a Serbian striker called Dusan Vlahovic. And, you know, obviously they've had doubts over their forward options. Aubameyang, who we spoke about, who seems to be out of favour with everybody at the minute. And Lacazette, his future at the club's kind of like, you know, do we know where he's coming or going? But this Fiorentina forward, Vlahovic, he's notched 16 goals and 3 assists in 20 appearances in the Serie A this season, which amounts to a 56% goal participation rate for the team. Who scored gave the 21-year-old a rating of 7.31 for the season, which is fairly high for strikers. And his market value is anticipated to be around 70 million euros. Obviously a proven player in a top European league. But as we spoke about earlier, and as we've seen so often, these players that make big money moves at ages of 21 to another country, there's a huge element of risk. So I'll give it to you first, Jim. What do you think? Does this sound like it could be a good move for Arsenal?
Well, a big forward from Fiorentina just reminds me of Gabriel Batistuta, who
Batigol.
Yeah, oh, mate, what kind of a nickname is that? Batigol. Like, it's the best, isn't it? And he was absolutely lethal, but I'm not saying that Vlahovic is going to be anywhere near that level. I did watch a highlight video of him the other day, and it was almost as bad as the one for Luis Ortiz and Charles Martin. It just showed him fluffing chances and basically looking uncoordinated. It might have been like an inside job from a fucking Chelsea fan or something. But then I watched another one, which showed him as a very capable target man. He's winning the ball in the air, bringing others into play, and showed a fair few tidy finishes as well. I've heard figures of up to 150 million for this guy, all in. And it's a matter of, is he worth it? Like, do Arsenal want to pay it? It doesn't matter if he's worth it. It's whether Arsenal can pay it. And with Aubameyang, like, I think he's gone. As soon as I can get him out the door, he's gone. Lacazette, I'm not sure if his peak is gone, but I'd like to see Arsenal keep him because I think he hasn't scored as many goals as Aubameyang has in his, like, when he's like flying and top form. But I also think that Lacazette brings a lot more to the team. I think his work rate's a bit higher. I think his assists are on point. And he just seems like a generally a good influence on the front line. Mm-hmm. But if Arsenal can get Vlahovic in alongside Martinelli and Smith Rowe and keep Saka amidst this Liverpool speculation that sprung up out of nowhere, they'll have a pretty dangerous, youthful front line that, if it proves fruitful, will surely be decimated by offers from bigger clubs in the coming seasons. But before that, I'm hoping Vlahovic can maybe be the new Olivier Giroud for a few seasons at least.
And just to put a quick stat in about Vlahovic, last year he scored his 33rd goal in Serie A, 33rd goal of the calendar year, so not season, but he's equaled Ronaldo's record set in 2020. I think it might be quite a big deal.
Yeah, it's relatively impressive.
Here on the podcast, yeah. We're not really into Ronnie that much.
Yeah. I think he's bang average myself. But the thing is, Arsenal are making moves, man. And for the first time in a long time, I've been encouraged by the activity that's been reported from their side. Like, as of yesterday, I think Arsenal are also maybe moving for Artemelo from Juve on loan to bolster the midfield because Palace are reportedly interested in Nketiah. Now, Artemelo, he likes to pick a pocket or two, man. I think he'd be a great addition to the midfield with Odegaard. My Norwegian brethren, maybe you can teach Granit Xhaka how to tackle without getting a red card as well. The Gunners love a bit of January transfer action, man. I don't know what it is, but they tend to do a lot of business at the top end. So I'm hoping all this can come off. I'm hoping things can move together. Top four, it seems, I don't want to say realistic, but I'm optimistic.
For sure. And the way they've been playing recently as well, I think is really, sort of made sure that point of view that they can go and maybe push on for the top four, made it a bit more realistic, hasn't it? And I think that'd be a good signing. Arthur Melo, obviously Brazilian. He'd come in with another young Brazilian along with Gabriel Martinelli. That seems a lot more realistic than them putting an offer of 100 plus million for Vlahovic, because Arsenal traditionally don't sort of spend those higher, the higher ends of the transfer fees, do they? Do you know what I mean? They don't really go past, I think there was Pepe their largest ever signing, 65 million, was it? 76?
I think it was 85, but do you remember, like, Arsenal, it was Arsene Wenger balancing the books for the new stadium. And famously, when they were still a viable destination for Luis Suarez, they put in that bid for 30 million and like £1 or something to just break, just to get the negotiations rolling. It's like, mate, this is when Luis Suarez was like at the peak of his powers, and you're going to put in a bullshit like bid like that. Just pay 50 and get it over with, man. You know what I mean? It was just, but I understand the logic behind all that. I think now that the stadium isn't a concern anymore, and as you've said many a time, Bissett, the big spenders get the big results. And I think that's just a reality of football. And if they've got the funds, they should be using them, I think.
Yeah, I think it's about time that Arsenal did put their money where their mouth is. But would that be the signing that's really going to, make a huge impact on the club? I still think they need a good centre midfielder, man. I think obviously your man Xhaka had a great Euros with Switzerland. And
it's infuriating, absolutely infuriating.
He has had a couple of good performances this year, but once again, he's just a liability man, and he's not the sort of player you want leading your team. So I do think they still need to get that right before they go spending 100 million plus on a striker. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and stop getting red cards every other fucking game. Like, you know, if you're not the best team in the country, how about don't put yourself in a 10 man handicap against Liverpool and Man City? Do you know what I mean? Like, what the fuck?
And obviously, Elneny's on international duty with Egypt, I believe. And now he's got a sending off. So it's no wonder they're trying to cancel their game against Tottenham, isn't it? I think they've come up and saying that they're trying to cancel it due to coronavirus cases, and probably because they've not really got that many centre midfielders at the club at the minute either. Do you know what I mean? So yeah.
I wouldn't want that smoky smoke from Spurs either, man. From Conte's turning them around.
Mind you, they've been shit lately. Two legs against Chelsea. They've been pretty shocking. But what was happening in the El Clasico this week? It was in like Abu Dhabi or something, wasn't it?
I don't know.
It was somewhere. Yeah, it was pretty strange.
The promotional hype train's going, and it's get football in the Middle East before Qatar. Nerves.
It's for the fans. It's not for the money. Though.
They're trying to break.
It's definitely for the fans. Of course it is.
They're just trying to brainwash you into like getting comfortable with the idea of having football in the Middle East on a higher level before you even get there. I'm surprised the Champions League final weren't there last year. No? But the Clásico, this was in the semi-final of the Spanish Super Cup, and it just popped up on my YouTube thing. I wouldn't have known about it otherwise. But it was a pretty, considering the respective positions of each team, it was a pretty compelling affair. So with Barcelona spiralling, as I mentioned earlier, in La Liga this season, they managed to put on a pretty prideful performance that brought them within touching distance of getting a result against their great rivals, Real Madrid. In the end, it wasn't enough. Real won 3-2. And they were pretty wasteful early on. I think Vinny Jr. broke the deadlock after Karim Benzema, praise be. Pick Boost gets his pocket. He played a 1-2 with Modric. Then he put in Vinny on goal with a lovely ball outside of the right foot. And then Vinny just had too much pace for the centre-back. Like, top left, lovely finish. They could have been 3 or 4 nil up at that point. I think this was like half an hour into the game. But Barcelona, fair play to them for getting back into the game. But their equaliser was absolutely scrag, man.
And who's it from as well? Luke de Jong, who has no... another player has no business being in a Barcelona shirt.
I didn't even realise there was two de Jongs playing for Barcelona. So the smaller de Jong, he headed it out to Dembele on the
Frankie.
Left wing. He played a low ball back across the six-yard box. Militao, who had a fucking shocker of a game for Madrid, he tried to clear, but the bigger De Jong was already bearing down on him.
Daddy De Jong.
The ball bounced off his calf, then hit the post, and then finally crossed the line past the helpless Courtois. I mean, we're talking about FIFA glitches, man. That was one for the ages, that was. But... oh God, this is such a far cry from the sick like Barcelona Real Madrid clashes from back in the day, like the one where Messi scored a fucking hat trick to like beat them 3-2 and all that. This is just shoddy, isn't it? But Pedri and Dembele, they came close to Barca. Busquets probably should have been sent off for elbowing Vinny Jr. in the face 2 inches from the ref. I don't know why this wasn't an issue. It was absolute blatant Muay Thai levels, man. Worse than Sadio Mane the other week, absolutely. Benzema hit the post after some tidy hold up play in the box. Shortly after, he forced De Stegen to full stretch. He could only push the ball to Carvajal, though. He smashed the ball back in. De Stegen saved again. Then Benzema just steered the ball home, really. You'd expect it from him. And his goal-scoring record... his goal-scoring record over the past, like, couple of years, I think he's only second to Ronaldo over... maybe Messi and Ronaldo over the long term. Literally,
yeah,
like,
probably doesn't get enough credit, does he, really? Goals. But, yeah, he's pretty incredible.
He's unreal, man. And Xavi, the Barcelona legend who's taken over at the helm, he looked as sick as a dog when Real took the lead. But his boy, Ansu Fati, great name, was there in the 82nd minute with a headed equaliser from close range. He found space between the two centre-backs to get on the end of a lovely Jordi Alba cross. And at that point, even though Barca was still outgunned and were being outplayed, they gave themselves a lifeline. They showed good character throughout, but to be fair, they did ride their luck at times. So you can imagine the heartbreak 7 minutes into extra time when Real broke and had 4-2 going into the box. And it was basically training ground shit from then. Rodrigo burst down the right, played the ball across. Vinny gave the dummy. Then Valverde arrived late with enough time to take a touch. He sent the stag in the wrong way. Terrific winning goal. Now Madrid are now through to the final where they'll face Athletic Club, who shockingly beat Atletico Madrid the other day. And like, I thought that was a wash for fucking... I thought it was going to be an all-Madrid final. Barca now sits sixth in La Liga with two wins and three draws from the last five. Xavi's kind of steadied the ship, but they're an age away from the great tiki-taka dons that like basically schooled United 3 years out of four, was it, in the Champions League finals. Absolutely killing it. So, yeah, it's... I don't think Real Madrid were the team that they have been. They're just miles and miles ahead of Barcelona, who... They're just, they're not even a shadow. They're an imitation of the shadow they once were. It's kind of depressing, but I think the one optimism you can take from it is that the only way is up for real. Like, did you watch any of the games?
I watched probably about 15 minutes. I was flicking between that, and I think there was an Italian Super Cup game on as well, and the African Cup of Nations. So there's quite a lot going on. So I was sort of flicking back and forth. But as you just... You hit the nail on the head. Barcelona light years away from what they were, you know, in the glory days, really. And, you know, Xavi's come in and, yeah, steadied the ship slightly, but we can't expect too much from him, like, at the moment, can we, really? Because he's not been there long enough to really sort of, you know, try and implement his ideas. He needs to have, you know, a real clear out, and he needs to, you know, try and bring in players that he trusts. Because I think what Barcelona have done for far too long now is they've still got this sort of mentality that they're, all right, they're a huge club, and the revenue streams that they have bring in a lot of money for the club. And that'll probably always be there, even after losing Messi. I'd imagine their appeal has been dented slightly since losing Messi, but I still think they need to try. And I still feel like they feel like they need to try and get those big money signings, but maybe that's probably not the strategy they need to go with. Maybe they need to try and figure out, all right, let's try and bring in some players that, you know, are just going to build. You know, they're going to build from the bottom, bring in some young lads like Ansu Fati that are coming through the academy. Use that La Masia system that that's been so successful for a long time, and try and bring in some youth players that are actually going to develop the team from the ground up.
You said they need to have a clear up. Who do you think they should get rid of?
I'll tell you right now. Sorry, Bissi, to jump on top of you. You know, the other day against Madrid, this was when I seen them all standing together, I was gobsmacked. There's Dani Alves, Sergio Busquets, and Pique. Like, these are old school heads, man. I'm surprised fucking Luis Figo.
The three dudes from Barcelona.
Yeah, yeah. I'm surprised Luis Figo didn't come off the fucking bench. Do you know what I mean? It was absolutely ridiculous. These are like,
Musketeers, like.
Yeah, but you know, listen. Busquets in his day, probably one of the most underrated midfielders in the world. And to see him have his pocket picked by Benzema spoke volumes to me. That would have never happened back in the day, ever. And like, obviously, Pique is a centre-back. He's got more scope to be like, he could probably lose a bit of pace and position and all that. But the rest of the team's not working to his advantage. Dani Alves was getting duppied for jokes on the left-hand side by Mendy. It was madness. Like, that. Dani Alves, one of the most decorated right backs in the history of the game. They all have their prime players, and his is long gone. And he's just a name on a shirt. He just represents an idea. He should not be playing for a top level European club anymore, I don't think. So those are the kind of people you should be getting out of there.
Definitely, there's a huge disparity between those players that have been there for a long time, or that are very, very well known within the club, and have that, hold that sort of like sentiment of the old Barcelona team that we know, the old tiki-taka style under Guardiola. And then you've got these new players that are coming through now, like Gavira, who's the 18-year-old that basically is being burnt out already. His name's Pedri. Yeah, that obviously for Spain, been burnt out already. And he's playing a lot of football, even at the age of 18. I can't see him lasting past 28, the amount of football he's playing. And then you've got Ferran Torres, who they've just signed from Man City for 55 million quid. I think still only 21, 22. So there's kind of like that real, I don't know, they haven't really quite got the balance right, have they, between the old heads and the younger players coming through. So it's difficult, man. Obviously, Ousmane Dembele, you can't see him being there for much longer. He started the other night. Luke de Jong. So do they even know what their philosophy is, or what their future looks like with these players? There's no clear future, is there?
Well, it's like you said, though. Yeah, Xavi hasn't had enough time. He's only had, like, what is it, a month, 2 months?
Yeah.
You know, I think once you give him a good run, I think if anyone's going to have a philosophy, if you bear in mind how he came up through the game, it's going to be someone like him. So we might be having a different conversation in 12 months' time when all the contract shit has kind of settled down and, you know, some players have moved on, other players have been getting more game time, build their confidence. I think the scope is good for them to improve, but we'll see, man. They could just fucking get relegated or something. I don't know.
And yeah, just the last word on the transfers. Where do we see, and on the football stuff in general, do we see Haaland going anywhere this in the January? There has been talks about him going somewhere for a lot of money. The only club that springs to mind would be Man City. Do you think they would be interested in signing for, you know, I don't know, 150 million? It'd have to be, wouldn't it?
Well, you know, I was watching Sergio Aguero's fucking top 10, like, amazing things, or 10 times Aguero, like, did some done shit or whatever. That wasn't the video title. I'm paraphrasing. But, listen, that geezer was fucking unbelievable, man. He was unbelievable. And I don't think you'd be hard-pressed to find another striker like that within the generation. And Haaland's obviously a different type of player. But I'll kind of turn the question back at you. Do you think Haaland's the type of player that would fit into the Man City setup, their philosophy, the way they play? I think De Bruyne would put the ball on anyone's head and on the tip of anyone's toe. So that's not really a problem. The service won't be a problem. But are we going to encounter the kind of difficulties that Lukaku's experienced at Chelsea, like a big man who's not given the impetus to lead the line? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, potentially. I think the way Borussia Dortmund played lends itself into, you know, ensuring that his attributes are really, that really flourish in this, in the way they play. So you're always worried because the way Man City play, and you know, you got Grealish that has gone there struggling really to adapt to the sort of high intensity and the very specific ball control and the ball retention sort of style of play that Man City have. So you see great players that go there and struggle with the expectation that Guardiola has. I don't think he'd be a problem because, as you just said, they got players like De Bruyne, they got players like Bernardo Silva that can carve chances out for players very, very easily. So I think he'll always have opportunities. I think if he went there, you could see him scoring 20 goals a season. He's still only, what, 22. He's got some remarkable records. Do you know what I mean? Even at international level, he's like, what do we say a few weeks ago? He was Norway's fourth highest scorer already. At the age of 22, 23?
Yeah, because Norway have got a supreme lineage of international footballers.
John Crewe?
Oh, my God.
Quite a difficult accolade to get that.
Yeah, so they're going to smash that.
I think Haaland, with his physicality and his aggression, would actually be a great suit to the Premier League. I mean, especially now with the way, like, fouls are going. Like, he's not really going to be getting into, like, mad centre-back battles, is he? He's just going to be running roughshod over the back lines, like, depending on how Man City choose to employ him. But I think you're right about the price tag, which would be prohibitive for 9 out of 10 teams. He's not going for any small amount of money, then his wages, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, there's only a certain crop of teams that he could potentially go to, and Man City, PSG, probably Barcelona, probably. I don't think that he could go in for him at this point in time. Maybe Real Madrid could. But yeah, there's only, what, 3 or 4 teams that he potentially could go to. So be interesting to see what does happen, because I think he will move on. All right, Sam. So because we haven't spoken much about the NFL for the regular season, we'll quickly do a roundup of that. Now we're at the playoff stage. So the longest NFL regular season in history has come to an end after an exciting 18-week campaign. And we now know the teams that will be competing in the prodigious playoffs. So the Green Bay Packs and the Tennessee Titans finish the season as conference number one seeds and get their bye into the divisional rounds. The Titans will play either the Steelers, who progressed on the final day after an overtime win against the Baltimore Ravens, or Pat Mahomes' KC Chiefs, who have they've had a bit of an indifferent season, you know, for their standards so far. But the Packers will play either the Philadelphia Eagles or Brady's Buckaroos in the divisional round. And we'll have to play either the Cardinals, the LA Rams, the 49ers, or the Dallas Cowboys to reach the Super Bowl. As you can see, Jim, neither my Chicago Bears or your Atlanta Falcons made it to the playoffs.
I can't say I'm surprised, to be honest with you. I don't think, well, I fell off watching them pretty quickly, and I didn't see that much encouraging signs, or that many encouraging signs from them. It was, I think, when you struggle to watch highlights, I think you have to just admit that a sport isn't for you, man. But I wanted to be into it. I wanted to have the conversations with you and Pizzy and Stitch. I just don't get it. I'd get it, but I don't get it, if you know what I mean.
And I think Big Red will be pleased that his Aaron Rodgers Green Bay Packers. Now he's his anti-vax number one hero. He's come through with his team, and so they're going to be one of the favorites to win the Super Bowl. But on the AFC side of the draw, the Las Vegas Raiders beat the LA Chargers in their shootout for a wild card place in overtime because of an earlier game in which the Colts lost to the hapless Jaguars for only their third win of the season, and it opened up a bit of a nightmare scenario for the NFL. I think they were heavily anticipating that the Colts would win. And then you wouldn't have this scenario between the Raiders and Chargers that if they were to both play for a draw, both teams would have progressed to the playoffs. And I don't think they were expecting this. And it very, very nearly happened. And it was flashing memories of that game in 1982 from the World Cup between Germany and Austria, something we mentioned on the podcast before, called the Disgrace of Gijon, as it was coined by the media, essentially where Germany and Austria were both guaranteed to go through if Germany won, but Austria didn't lose by two goals or more.
I was going to say, every time Germany and Austria get together, there's just trouble in there. I think you should sit them on opposite sides of the classroom, for sure, man. But what's it going? Pronounce this word.
Yeah.
I can't wait to hear it.
Nichtangriffspakt, I reckon that's how it's pronounced.
That was pretty good.
Yeah.
And it means the non-aggression pact of Gijon. So that was a completely different, a complete 180 degree U-turn on what the rest of the media was calling it.
Usually they're wrecking the place, man.
This town, Gijon, would this be a town in Spain by any chance?
Yeah, of course. The World Cup was in Spain, so that's where the match was played. Yeah.
So that town's called Gijon.
Gijon.
All right, Flynn. Did you know Flynn lives in Spain? Anyway,
I don't think I've ever mentioned it.
So what would have happened with this game is if they would have just knelt every time they were in possession of the ball. So when their offense had the ball, they could have just knelt everything out. So the game finished 0-0 and they both would have gone through. But, you know, that would have been absolutely like horrendous and people would have been called it the disgrace of Las Vegas or wherever it was played.
Good for Black Lives Matter, though.
Yeah.
Everyone does that.
Yeah, and everyone's taking the knee. So the Raiders, yeah. So they'll go on and play Cincinnati Bengals or the Patriots and have an AFC East card wild card matchup against the Bills. So the Patriots got to play the Bills, which is weird because they're both in the same AFC East division. I didn't really know that could happen, but there you go. Need to ask somebody that knows what they're talking about for that. And all in all, we've had a pretty exhilarating season in the NFL. We've seen plenty of game-winning field goals, wins in overtime, and plenty of drama. It's just a shame we have to wait 8 months to watch it every year for the fans of the NFL. It's just too long.
That's all right. I think that's all right. 8 months. Also, I didn't realize that so much was up in the air, like liable to change when it comes to this stuff. Like, realize there were so many problematic matchups and potential results, man. They want to get their head screwed on, man. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot of money to be made here, basically, that you think.
It's quite complex how they do the playoff scenarios and the seeding and all that. But yeah, it's. I do feel like they could stretch it to like a 25 season. You know, what I mean, 25 week season. I have a lot more games. Maybe play each other twice or something. They do play each other twice in the divisional rounds, but it's only like four teams in a division, so there's only so many games. And then the other half of the games are just randomly allocated. Really, really weird fixture system.
Yeah, or play each other half the amount of times and then just see what happens, isn't it? You know, just call it, just have an end date and whatever doesn't cross that line, just you fuck it off, isn't it? Sweet.
All right, let's do the things you might have missed because we've got about seven this week, so we're going to have to rattle through these. We've got an early contender for shit-outs of the season, Lincoln's Chris Maguire, who used to play for Sunderland, scored against them in their midweek fixture at the Stadium of Light. His initial muted celebration was then followed by a sprint over to his ex-manager, Lee Johnson, to give it the big one right in front of his face. I thought this was excellent shithousery.
I thought it was brilliant, but the company man in me feels like warning him about burning bridges. But the human in me feels like saying, like, could you imagine just not only sticking it to your old boss, but doing it while you've scored a hat-trick against him and his boys in their own stadium? And it was a hat-trick, wasn't it?
I'm not sure if it was. It might have been. I think they won 2 or 3-1. It might have been a hat-trick, you never know, it might have been a brace. But there's obviously been some bad blood between them, isn't there? Like, I think he was there when he was sold, so he obviously didn't rate him as a player, but there must be more that there must be more to it than that. Do you know what I mean? They must have had some real falling out for him to go and do that. Every player gets sold at some point in their career, don't they? Or most of them do anyway.
I think the official line is that they didn't renew the contract, but after that, there must be something behind it, I think.
You'd assume so.
I think you're right.
All right, number two, this year's FIFA World Cup in Qatar will be the first ever to use a transportable stadium that can be dismantled and reassembled anywhere in the world. So the stadium's constructed using 974 shipping containers, with plus 974 also being the international dialing code for Qatar, which I thought was a great little tie-in there. So when you've got the dough and you can do pretty much anything you want, you know what I mean? Why not?
Well, you know, they did this for the Anthony Joshua, Andy Ruiz rematch. So they've got, I think it was out in Riyadh, and I think they might have done it for the finals of the super middleweight, what was that tournament? The World Super Series or something. They've got form for doing this. Obviously, there's no point having a permanent stadium in the middle of the desert. So, and also, if you've got a load of lads in the country who work for cheap because the bosses hold their passports, then you can do whatever you want, innit? Your places like Dubai don't spring out of the ground out of fair trade practices, do they? So it's all good. I mean, fair play to them. We need to see football in the desert, don't we?
It's 100%.
I don't know how I've lived without it so far.
Yeah. And to be honest, I think they probably learned the lessons, FIFA, from 2010 in Brazil, where they built all these new stadiums, like 12 brand new stadiums. And now, like, they're being used by teams that can barely get like 2,000 people in the stadium. So it's just a monumental waste of money. And, you know, FIFA go on about like, oh, they're trying to bring football to like all corners of the globe. But then they drop this like mammoth, all right, you need these 12 high-end like facilities to host the games in. And then they don't get used. And like countries end up spending billions of pounds. It's just a waste of money, really. So it's a bit hypocritical, really. But we've never been a great advocates of FIFA on this podcast, have we? Anyway, so go on. You have comedy man Flynn, of course he has. But number three,
they're just doing their best.
Circumstances. Mate. All they're doing, they're just trying to bring football to all the people, man. Just trying to make it a people's game, aren't they? All right, number three, back in the NFL, the ominously named Black Monday has been and gone in the NFL, and head coaches and backroom staff of multiple franchises have been given the chop. The date in question follows the end of the regulation season fixtures and is the first day that many struggling teams announce coaching or front office shakeup. So Miami Dolphins, New York Giants, Denver Broncos, Minnesota Vikings and Chicago Bears all relieved their head coaches this week, with all but one of their teams recording losing seasons. So the big surprise would have been Brian Flores for the Dolphins, as they had a fairly strong season as they went 9-8, and it looked like there were signs of progressions in Miami, so that one really didn't make sense. Matt Nagy with the Bears has become a vilified figure in the city, so his departure was expected. Other head coaches such as Joe Judge in New York and Mike Zimmer in Minnesota were anticipated. And we also had, of course, the departure mid-season of John Gruden in Las Vegas and Urban Meyer in Jacksonville, after their misogynistic, homophobic and racist behaviour. More the former than the latter. Urban Meyer was just fingering a chick's arsehole.
And that's not a crime anywhere. I mean, that's such a blunt turn of phrase. It's caught me off guard. But on to number four. And this might be my favourite pun of the year so far. Novak Kovidovic. And you can't take
Novak Djokovic.
Yeah, Novak Djokovic. honestly, that makes me just a sumptuous wordplay there. But the saga with his COVID controversy goes on. So here's one from the Express. I don't even know if they're like a good source of news, really. I don't suppose they are, but let's just go with it, man. So Novak Djokovic may still yet be kicked out of Australia before the Open, with the country's border force investigating whether or not he falsified travel documents. Now, this wasn't part of the initial story, which is, if he did this, then, you know, he's asking to have the book thrown at him, really. Djokovic incorrectly claimed he had not traveled for 2 weeks before landing down under, and has also admitted he breached the COVID isolation rules while in Serbia before Christmas. Basically, he had his visa revoked on January 6th after landing in Australia. and he's tested positive for COVID in December. He was then held in a detention in Carlton, Melbourne for 5 days, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But a judge ordered the release of the player from detention on Monday this week, insisting the decision to cancel his visa was unreasonable. So this has kind of gone beyond, it's not really about the Open anymore. It's about whether he's going to get locked up or not. So do you see, like, where do you see this going? I imagine he's got the dough to, you know, kind of finagle his way out of this. But I don't think he anticipated this amount of trouble when I think he just basically tried to walk in there, bitty big bollocks, like, and be like, I'm playing in the Open. I can purify water with my mind. What can't I do? I'm the world's number one.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be taking a turn for the worse for him. Every time there's more information about it. And it's quite interesting the way sort of like different bodies are having different stances on it. Like one minute he's getting revoked. Next minute, it's been overturned. Like, where is he? Obviously, he's not. Well, it doesn't look like he's going to play, does he? When does it start? Is it next week the Australian Open starts?
Monday. And the courts made their final decision on closing hours of Friday and they shut for the weekend. So
what a massive fuck you. Yeah. So I'll finish at 5, mate. Clock off in a bit.
Talking about shithousery today, I think they've won.
Chiming in, eh?
Boris Becker's got involved. Yeah, former world number one Boris Becker has said that Djokovic has become too involved in a political game and no player is bigger than the tournament, which is fair enough. And then also, a survey of 60,000 people carried out by an Australian agency, News Corp, before Hawke's decision. Hawke's the judge who made this decision on the Friday. Before that decision, showed that 83% of people out of that 60,000 people said that Djokovic should not be allowed into the country.
It's not like Australians to be like mad against foreigners, is it? Fucking mental, that is.
As we said last week, though, Australia's had some very strict lockdown rules, and for someone who's not from there to just turn up and think they don't need to follow the rules, I kind of get it.
Well, you know, I'm more
a rich dude turns up thinking, oh, I don't need to follow the rules you guys have followed.
I'm more disappointed in myself for not utilising the first 20 minutes of this podcast to be pro-vaccine for Joe Barr's listening enjoyment than I am in the Australian authorities for doing this. It's up to them, innit? I don't give a ball. I can't really feel sorry for COVID Djokovic Novaks. I just can't feel sorry for him. His life's going to go on. He's going to carry on winning trophies. Tremendous sportsman. But I think he tried to play his hand. I think he's misplayed his hand, basically.
Tries to pull a fast one, isn't he, basically? So,
yeah,
so.
Definitely. But slightly more uplifting news for number 5. Footage has emerged of Christian Eriksen smashing in a pinpoint free kick on the training ground of Swiss club Chiasso. Eriksen is a free agent, having been released from Inter Milan after his horrific cardiac arrest at Euros last year. And it looks as if the Dane is targeting a return for the World Cup. I love anyone willing to confound all sensible advice to do the thing they love. Big up the great Dane. Sergio Aguero recently had to retire following his own heart troubles. Fingers crossed for Eriksen that he doesn't have a relapse of some description. This is uplifting for once.
I got huge respect to him for this. He reminds me of the David Goggins of professional football man. Stay hard. And he also reminds me of Arnie when he drew Mr. Olympia when it looked like he wasn't going to get it. And
who's going to carry the boat? And I found this. I'll tell you what, next one's about Floyd Mayweather and Kim Kardashian basically doing a Ponzi scheme. So I think we can pick that up on a later date. We'll cut that out.
Should we just jump straight to the last one? Yeah. All right, then. Yeah. So the last one, and this is something I heard on the radio the other day, and I thought, oh, this has got to go in. So ESPN talking, talking head.
Wait, are we talking head, boy?
He's a talking head.
I don't even know what's going on there. But yeah, basically, former Ravens and Jets linebacker who worked for ESPN. Big head, obviously. His name's Bart Scott, anyway. But he offered some creative advice to Bills quarterback Josh Allen on how to battle the frigid conditions during Thursday's Get Up show. But basically, host Diana Rossini revealed that Allen told her he doesn't like playing in cold weather because he has bad circulation that affects his feet. Scott said he has a performance-enhancing suggestion. Try Viagra. Take a Viagra before the game, baby. That'll get the circulation going right. What do you reckon of this?
So they were talking head, really, weren't they? You know what I
mean? But he went on to say, is Bart Scott, he went on to say that his days as a player, players that are taking Viagra was rife, man. And the drug Sildenafil helps blood circulate around the body. which obviously culminated in scientists like tripping up on the discovery that it keeps your penis erect for a substantial amount of time. It was initially used for treating heart disease and high blood pressure, also developed by Pfizer. So there's some fun facts.
That is a happy accident if I ever heard one, man.
Ain't it? And the happiest.
That's like stubbing your toe and just like kicking open a suitcase with $300 million in it, isn't it?
The same with penicillin. Wasn't penicillin accidentally discovered as well?
I think it was discovered on moldy bread, wasn't it?
Yeah, some shit like that.
Alexander Fleming, he left his sandwich to go off in the lab and then there was some mold on it and he ate it and he got better. I don't know.
Fleming, you're not playing Trivial Pursuit. How many times? Life is not a Trivial Pursuit, and if it was, you'd be absolutely rinsing it, man. 100% record.
Well, that's the end of the things you might have missed. Let's go through the combat sports review and anything that's coming up this weekend.
Yeah, it's a quick one this week, man. The only thing to report from last week is Zhang Jingnan versus Ayaka Miura for the one strawweight title, which finished just a few hours ago. The stars aligned for me. I got in from work, and boom, it was just starting. So this was a boxer versus judoka. Classic old school matchup. Zhang came into this bout with the most title wins in one strawweight history and 10 KOs in the last 16 victories against only two defeats. Miura, ranked fourth in the division, was seen as the last viable contender before Zhang potentially moves division. And the story of the fight was simple. Miura had one plan, take Zhang down, and she committed to that plan with everything she had. She must have attempted about 20 takedowns, and she'd always managed to get Zhang to the cage, but that's about as far as she got because Zhang's takedown defense was impeccable. She'd shift her hips to the side with her hands on Miura's hips or get the over-under on or a body lock. And the next thing you know, she's rolling out and shrugging Miura off. She defended every single one of them. It was outstanding. And Miura actually did a decent job of minimizing Zhang's striking threat by constantly shooting in. But when they're in the middle of the cage, the difference in striking skill was evident. Zhang was quick and showed good variety with the left hook, the right leg kick, and the front kick, showing dividends especially. And she was the clear winner. Miura looked absolutely exhausted by the end of the fifth round and heartbroken at the decision. Zhang looked fresh as the daisy. And she's a tasty fucker, man. She taunted Miura throughout the fight, beckoning her in, etc., sticking her tongue out, shouting. But she was super chill after the fight until her Chairman Mao-esque interview when they asked her about her next opponent. So, yeah, the change in tone and mannerism when she was like, oh, thanks for the fight. And then they're like, do you want to fight Angela Lee? And she was like, I'll bullshit out. It's like going on a fucking mad one. So you could see that there's a real competitor there, despite her rather delicate outlook in the beginning of the interview. So
I clocked that in the fifth, and they were sort of like having a bit of really just sort of shouting at each other, sort of like mid-fight. She won't take it kindly. She don't take kindly to that sort of thing.
We don't take kindly to your cameraman. But in further news from Singapore, one CEO, Chatri Sidyatdong, who reminds me of Hayahachi from Tekken, by the way, has just announced a load of mad fights during his appearance on Ariel Helwani's MMA Hour. And the one I'm most looking forward to is a special rules super fight between former UFC flyweight champion and one Grand Prix winner, Demetrius Mighty Mouse Johnson, and the reigning one flyweight Muay Thai champion, Rod Tang, the Ike Man, Jip Mung Nam. The rules consist of 4 3-minute rounds alternating between MMA and Muay Thai rules. Now, this is genuinely meeting each fighter halfway, and I can't think of a situation where you'd see this at the very highest level in the West. I'm so glad to be back on the one train. That is like some made-up, do-your-settings type vibe.
But which is the first round? Because then there's an advantage.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how it's going to play out, you know. I'm not sure. Say, like, if it's Muay Thai first, and then you get to take down. I understand what you mean, but it depends if they judge it round by round as well, because the fight between Zhang and Miura, the fight's judged as a whole. They don't do round by round. It's a completely different philosophy.
And this is Muay Thai. They don't do round by round.
No, in one championship, the organization, depending on the rule set, they will judge the fight as a whole rather than it's different.
Like, that could work. That could work.
But I think because they're alternating between styles, they will do it round by round.
Because otherwise, it's going to be very difficult to score it, really, isn't it?
Could they judge the MMA rounds together and then the Muay Thai rounds together and do that? Maybe, this is interesting.
Yeah. I've never heard of anything like this. So I'm going to be tuning in. I think that's on their 1X card, the 10th anniversary of one championship. March 15th, I think it is. I'm definitely going to be watching it. They stream everything live on YouTube as well, which is like, and it's like 11 in the day or something like that. There's nothing not to love about it. So that's all from last week. And the preview from this week is better than last week, but not as good as it's going to be in February and in March. So boxing in the UK has been prohibited until February due to COVID nerves. Mm. But we were looking forward to Callum Johnson challenging Joe Smith Jr. for the WBO light heavyweight title on Saturday. Unfortunately, Callum Johnson contracted SARS, so he's been replaced by Stephen Giffrard from Miami. That's not SARS, by the way. It's fucking COVID nerves. Yeah. Was it SARS? Was like the progenitor for COVID, and it back in the day.
They are related, yeah.
Yeah, they are. They're both SARS viruses. Yeah. Aren't
they? Oh, all right, SARS, Bissett. I'm a fucking virologist, not virologist.
Jesus, Bissett.
Oh, calm down, mate. God.
I've got a few. I've got a lot of friends that are medical. What was Flynn's always saying that, and he's always dropping that. I've got a lot of friends that are medical experts. Even though I work for an insurance company.
I watched House a few times. Yeah.
You know, I live in Spain, and I've got a few friends who are medical experts. So Callum Johnson's going to be replaced by Steve Giffrard from Miami. Giffrard has only been scheduled in a 12-rounder once. He's never gone the full distance. He's 31 years old. His record's 18-2 against largely unknown opposition. I don't fancy his chances against Smith Jr., who went a ridiculously tough 12 rounds against Maxim Vlasov last time out to claim the vacant belt. The UFC has a fight night card this Sunday, headlined by Calvin Kattar and Giga Chikadze. Co-main is going to be the back-flipping Brazilian Michel Pereira against Muslin Salikov. Salikov, who, this is another great nickname, the King of Kung Fu. He's undefeated in five fights, stretching back to his UFC debut in 2017. Pereira is back on track with three straight wins after back-to-back losses against Tristan Connolly and Diego Sanchez. The latter being by disqualification. You can see Petty Yan versus Aljamain Sterling for the details on that one. I like Pereira in a stand-up battle because of his variety and unpredictability, but I haven't seen enough of Salikov to make a proper pick. By the way, Pereira is reported as being 28 years old. Bollocks. Absolute bollocks, man. I don't know if he's...
You should make that your profession, mate. You should go around and like actually like test sports people and see what their true age is, because you just thought you love it.
You
do are.
That? What, you cut their legs and see how many rings there are?
Yeah. Like a tree trunk.
Listen, you pull up a picture of Pereira and you tell me he's not at least 37 and a half, man. There's no way. There's absolutely... No, I find it insulting, man. Anyway... As mentioned last week, Bellator isn't back until their 273 event on the 29th, headlined by Bader versus Modavsky for the heavyweight title. And that's it, man. It's another brief one, but as I said before, we've got a lot coming on February and in March. And as soon as SARS restrictions ease up, we'll be absolutely sweet. So that I think that's about it. And 10 minutes inside the limit for Flynn's departation time. So... That's it, man. I'm pretty happy with that.
Where's you got to go? You got any prior engagements? What you got, Flynn?
Just have an engagement. Need to get to. That's all.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, you got a date.
He's got to go, go see a man about a dog, man.
All right, sound chaps. Good to be back on the pod again. And we'll see you next week. Flynn will be back in Barca, so we'll have to do the three-way thing again. Hopefully the internet connection holds up.
It's always more enjoyable to do it in person, lads. I'm sorry. We're going to be separated by time and water again.
I just want to point out, it's not my internet connection that messed up, man.
Is it not? Are you sure?
It was definitely your dodgy New York.
No, it's because there's about six people on it. That's why. I mean, the neighbors are probably tuning in as well.
Is the house even overpopulated? I'm sorry about it.
I'm so sorry.
All right, Sam. See you next week, lads.
Take pleasure,
buddy.